You are listening to the Flash F1 podcast with Gil and Mark.
Hola, Flashers. Welcome to another episode of Flash F1. Mark and I are back for another exciting post-race podcast. So break out your piñata. We're going to bust them up. Just like how Renault got busted up and disqualified from the last race. Mark?
Sorry, who was disqualified from the last race?
Renault.
Oh, Renault. Yeah, that was a good one. Great introduction.
Thank you.
What do you think of the race?
The race, it was okay. A lot of the action was happening in the midfield, the mid-pack.
Sure.
But you know, Hamilton won the race. It was really good.
But you gotta give credit to the fact that we really didn't know, even with 20 laps left, who was going to win. Because we had that bunch of racers. We had Leclerc, Vettel, Bottas, Hamilton. And really more, maybe the conversation is more about Hamilton, Vettel, and Bottas. Like, we didn't know with 20 laps left who was going to win the race because Hamilton pitted so early and he had to run the balance of the bulk of the race on those hard tires. Like, we didn't know. And for me, that was interesting. But you're right, there was a ton of stuff happening in the midfield.
For me, the race was all about tire management, tire strategy. So could they go on with the hard tire plus 50 laps? Hamilton proved it.
Absolutely, he did. And I think if you listen to the Pirelli reps, they were saying, hey, that's probably at the far end of the tire wear expectations, and he made it work, so kudos to him. And it's crazy, too, and we'll get into it, but almost immediately after coming out of the box on those hard tires, he was screaming on the radio. And to be fair, here in Canada, we didn't hear it because TSN cut to a, like, four-hour commercial, but by all accounts, he was screaming about the tire durability and the fact that he didn't think he was going to make it to the end of the race, although I think we hear that quite often in Hamilton. Okay, cool. Maybe jump to a break and get back and jump into quali.
Sounds good.
Cool.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Search for Flash F1 Official.
Mark, before we get started, I'd like to start off by saying congrats to you on the great job you did with the latest special guest podcast interview that you did without me. For those of you that are wondering where I was, Mark did invite me to be on, but when he mentioned it was going to be about Formula One finances and economics, I fell asleep. I want to talk about passing, crashing, pitting, and winning. I did listen to episode 24 and found it very interesting, as most of you listeners did from the comments and DMs I've been reading on our social media. So we'd like to thank all of you again for the love and support. Mark, anything to add?
Yeah, that you're being very generous. And there wasn't so much an invite as, like, hey, I'm doing this thing. And then after I recorded it, message you and say, by the way, this is dropping tonight. Do you want to listen to it? And it's so funny, too, because you'd sent this message after you'd heard it the first time. And you're like, I don't know if our listeners are into this economic stuff.
I was so wrong.
But you know what? I think maybe some of them are, but a lot of them also gave me the feedback that I had no idea what was being talked about. Good job, but I had no idea what was happening. So, you know, we're just trying to broaden our appeal and broaden our listener base, but thank you.
Well, the messages I've been reading said it was very informative. It was something different.
Yeah.
You know, they're lapping up anything and everything that's Formula One related.
Yep.
Aside from, like, just talking about the race and tracks and teams and stuff, this was something different and, you know, it was a great interview.
Yeah. I appreciate that. And it's crazy too, because we actually went embarrassingly 3 weeks without a podcast because it took us so long to do the Japan GP one. And then in the span of 7 days, we were going to have dropped 3 podcasts and we have another one coming next week with Austin. So no, I appreciate that. And I think really we're starting to find our voice a little bit, but we're still trying to learn what it is that our listeners really, really want from us. So we're being a little bit experimental and trying different things. And I think anytime we can get somebody that can bring a new perspective or a new dimension or some sort of new knowledge to the podcast about racing and about the sport, or whether it be the economics of the racing or whatever the case would be, that's cool with us. And we're excited too, because we have a couple of other guests. I won't share them right now, but we have a couple of other guest interviews that are going to be on with us in the next couple of weeks. So we got lots of exciting stuff to do. And the other thing too, is just from a kind of a selfish perspective, doing interviews with people in the industry is also good for our exposure and exposing the show. So that's good. And the other thing that we have noticed too recently is that for most of the season, almost exactly 50% of our user listeners or our listeners were from Canada. That number is eroding, and the U.S. is representing more and more and more of our user base. So either we're scaring away the Canadians or we're becoming more compelling to our American listeners, which is also really, really cool. You want to talk a little bit about qualifying?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, so maybe before we get into qualifying, quick shout out to Nicholas Latifi, F2 driver, almost ready to wrap up his season. Unfortunately, won't win the championship because that's already been decided. He got the nod to sit in a Williams car for FP1. He was about 4.2, 4.3 seconds off of Index, off of the pace setter, and about a second off of Russell. That said, this is obviously an incredibly challenging track, which we'll speak to a little bit, and it's been a little while since he's been in one of these cars. I believe he's going to get a little bit more seat time before the end of the year, because obviously Williams is really trying to measure up whether he's a good fit for this team next year, because we know that Kubica won't be back. But that's really about the only, I think, interesting thing from free practice. Anything else from FP1, 2, 3?
1, 2 wasn't really too interesting for me. Stroll, not able to get out of Q1.
Oh, in Q, yeah.
So oh, sorry, jump Q1. To qualifying, FP, yeah. I'm so sorry. FP, you were talking about FP.
But you're right. Yeah. Q1, let's jump straight to qualifying, because there was nothing great from FP1, 2, 3. Qualifying, Stroll didn't get out of Q1 again.
Yeah, I was hoping he would, but his partner Perez did.
Yeah, and I want to circle back a little bit to Stroll as this podcast goes on too, because I'm genuinely disappointed with his performance this weekend, and it kind of started in qualifying. But, you know, qualifying Q3, Q2, Q1, I think it was really wrapped up in the final seconds of Q1. We saw a pretty significant tie-up between the driver and one of the walls. Maybe you want to speak to what happened in that final turn.
Oh, are we talking about Bottas?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So we're going into Q3. We've got two McLarens. We've got two Red Bull. We've got two Toro Rosso. We've got two Mercedes.
Yep.
We've got two Ferraris.
Yep.
All in Q3. We're looking at the final few seconds of qualifying, where Bottas ends up slamming into the sidewall and hits the protrusion towards the end of the wall. Has a pretty hard hit. He was fine. He limped a bit when he hopped out.
And he was breathing heavy. So by all accounts, it was a 17, and I don't know if this is significant because I'm not a NASA scientist, but apparently it was a 17G impact. And what you could hear in the radio before he got out of the car, what you could hear on the radio is that he was breathing really, really loudly.
Yes, I heard that as well.
Obviously a pretty significant impact.
Well, when you're, you know, even if you're sliding and running into a wall, you're reducing your speed, but what's that speed as you're like sliding or ramming into a wall, and how many G-forces that you're going to be at a dead stop. So that'd be terrifying and a toll on the body for anybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when that happened, Max Verstappen was right behind him and was completing his third qualifying or his final lap for qualifying. Apparently, he missed the yellow flag due to Bottas's crash, went right by him, and at that time had the fastest lap to qualify for pole.
Yeah, in the TV presentation, you know, he rolls right up into the one spot. He celebrates pole. Again, so this is a guy, too, we should probably mention that he won this race in 2017. He won the race in 2018. He's had a lot of success in Mexico. People talk a lot about Ferrari doing well here, but really it's been, since we returned to Mexico, I think Rosberg won in 15, Hamilton won in 16, Verstappen won in 17, 18. So he takes pole. Everything's good. The broadcast wraps up. And only much later do we begin to hear that maybe he's not going to be on pole after all. And it's interesting because during the post-qualifying interviews, a reporter from ESPN repeatedly pressed him on, were you aware that Bottas had crashed? Did you see yellow flags? And kind of kept pressing and pressing and pressing. And ultimately, he got him to admit that he knew that Valtteri Bottas had crashed, and more importantly, that he didn't lift off when he knew. So the FIA, and I don't know that the FIA were even interested in investigating this, because it was pretty clear based on the onboard telemetry, like the race stewards can see in real time whether a driver lifts off the throttle or not, so they knew, but it kind of took Verstappen's comments in the interviews to prompt them to do an investigation. So hours and hours later, we realized that actually, you know what, he didn't lift off, and the onboard video showed that he clearly saw or could clearly see somebody on the side.
Waving the yellow flag. I had to watch the video replay a couple of times just to see, you know, that's exactly what I saw. You could see the guy waving the flag because there was something wrong with the with the digital flags or the digital signage that allowed for an actual human to actually wave the flag during, I think Bottas' crash possibly had something
could've
to do
been.
With that.
Yeah, it could have been. But to me, it was pretty clear. And the fact that he, one, acknowledged, like, and it's funny too, because if he'd almost lied, if he'd said in the interviews, like, yeah, I didn't know Bottas had crashed, or, hey, you know what, I did lift off the throttle 20% to be safe. But he admitted, like, I didn't lift off the throttle and I know he crashed. The FIA is forced to penalize him.
Yeah. And as a result of that, the penalization for Verstappen was a three-place grid penalty, putting him in, was it fourth position right after, was it Leclerc?
Yeah. So originally the actual race was going to be Max on pole, Leclerc, Vettel, Hamilton, Albon, Bottas. So Bottas had kind of slid down. He put in a time, but didn't put in a great time. Fortunately, Mercedes were able to repair the car and get him back onto the grid without any grid penalties. But in the end, it ended up being Leclerc, Vettel. So Ferrari ended up locking out the front row. And this is the sixth race weekend in a row in which they took pole. So they've had this great run, but it's Leclerc, Vettel, Hamilton, and then Bottas.
Yeah.
Or Bottas.
No, it was
Verstappen.
Leclerc, Vettel, Hamilton, Verstappen, then Bottas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to be clear for our listeners, just to be clear once again, it was Charles Leclerc.
Yep.
Sebastian Vettel.
Yep.
Ferrari front row lockout.
Yep.
Lewis Hamilton.
Max Verstappen.
Albon, Bottas.
That's right.
We've got it. We've come to an agreement on what it looked like. Okay, so that was qualifying. So basically, there was an accident. Fortunately, Bottas was okay. His car suffered a significant amount of damage. The Mercedes mechanics were able to get it back. They didn't have to replace a gearbox. They didn't have to replace a chassis, so there was no grid penalty. So he was successfully able to start the race on Sunday. He starts the race. That's okay. Verstappen obviously takes that grid penalty. First couple of laps, pretty interesting.
Yeah, so there's already like contact on the first couple of laps where I think it looks like Vettel kind of squeezed Hamilton.
Yep.
And then he was swerving, and then Max was swerving, and then they both went off the off track on the first couple of turns.
Yep, so they're both on the grass. And I don't know if it was in this precise moment, but one of the things that you often hear about floor damage, and you often hear about the impact of aerodynamics. Yeah. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting is after Hamilton hopped out of his car at the end of the race, he looks down, and you could see there was some pretty substantial floor damage on his car. So the fact that he managed to make those hard tires last as long as he did, plus managed to with that much floor damage, like imagine the impact to his aerodynamics and the additional wear that it would have put on the tires is pretty crazy. So yeah, the first lap is pretty messy. There's a little bit of contact. What else happened?
Lap five, Max Verstappen gets a puncture after, you know, that back and forth with Bottas. They were trying to pass each other. Yeah. He got a puncture, ended up having to pit.
But yeah, so he pits, and it's funny too, because it wasn't just a puncture in the sense that, hey, look, get into the box, you know, get a fresh set of tires on. Like, he had no tire. He was rolling around the track on an aluminum rim. Yeah. And the fact that he was then able to convert that appearance in the box to ultimately a sixth place finish. How did he finish in the end? Yeah, Max Verstappen converted that into a sixth place finish. Like, that's absolutely remarkable. It probably speaks to the quality of the midfield, but also speaks to the quality of the drive that he had after that impact. So crazy weekend for Verstappen.
Yeah, that tire actually came right off
and
went rolling right past Daniel Ricciardo, and he swerved to avoid it. So really good on Ricciardo for avoiding that contact with that tire.
Totally. So your thoughts then, like, we can get into the race a little bit. We know Hamilton ultimately wins the race. He picks up the points. But anything else? Because I want to talk a little bit about Stroll.
Okay, well, let me just go through some of the stuff that
please,
I picked up.
Please, just take us right through it.
Yeah, just for our listeners' sake, for some of them that may have missed some things. Lap 13, Norris pits and his front left tire is not on properly, so the team has to push the car back after they released him.
Yep.
Yeah. Lap 36, Sainz and Gasly midfield battle. Vettel almost hits them trying to lap them. So I guess the blue flags are out, and I guess they weren't getting away in time, and Vettel had to slam his brakes.
Yep.
Lap 44, Leclerc had the long pit, 4 second pit. He had some sort of right rear wheel issue.
Yeah, and it's funny too, because and this is one of those things that you learn as you watch more and more Formula One. Like the actual guns, the actual hub guns that basically lock that bolt lock the lug onto the car, it flashes green, indicating that it was a successful pit,
or which it
did
show.
Yeah, which it showed, and somebody within the team is screaming that it wasn't a successful. Like he hadn't successfully secured the wheel to the car, and he's basically like, "What the hell?" So it seemed totally unnecessary, but yeah, ultimately, how much time did that add to the
four
stop?
Seconds? Wow. It was a 4 second pit.
Wow, and ultimately, I don't know if that was going to have a huge impact on Leclerc's race, but if you're Leclerc, you're pretty choked.
Well, it didn't really have that much because in lap 59, he makes an unforced error and shoots out on the turn anyway. Yep. So lap 51, McLaren retires Norris.
Yep.
Yeah, it was a real shame. He's doing so well, but then they ended up having to retire him.
And it's unfortunate too because ultimately McLaren didn't pick up any points in this race, but they'd had a couple of great race weekends recently, and then they had this weekend and things just didn't break right for them at all.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, it was a shame for McLaren because they did really well this week, this qualifying and everything, getting into Q3,
yep.
Putting themselves in a good position. Lap 60, they end up retiring Raikkonen. So Raikkonen DNFs.
Second time in four races, yeah. So he's had a bit of string of bad luck here.
I got lap 61, Ricardo tries to pass Perez, and he shoots off into the grass.
Oh, so, that was ugly, too. Yeah. He's lucky he didn't get a puncture out of that one.
Yeah, that was a pretty severe one where he was trying to pass him, and then Perez kind of cuts in, and then Ricardo kind of shoots out onto the next turn.
And it's funny, too, because when Ricardo did return to the track, he was actually in front of Perez, but he immediately gave the position back.
Yeah, he gave the position back. Yeah, he had to.
Which is the right thing to do, because otherwise the stewards would have ordered him to do it. But yeah, that was ugly. And it's very unlike Ricardo, because Ricardo's generally considered one of the best overtakers in the sport. And maybe he just misjudged that corner and went in a little bit hot, but he went straight through the corner onto the grass, ultimately managed to recover. But there's a point where even when he stepped back onto the pavement, the back end of his car stepped out pretty badly, and he almost could have clipped the wall then too.
He could have avoided that if he had that automatic brake bias.
Maybe he's getting used to a car that's actually legal.
Yeah, so this is what happens when you actually have to use human actual braking and cornering. The last lap, Hülkenberg and Kvyat touch, so it causes Hülkenberg to stop on the track. So right at the last lap. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, can we talk about Stroll?
Can we talk about Leclerc getting the fastest lap?
So he picked up a point?
Yeah, he picked up a point.
We're done. Can we talk about Stroll?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about Stroll. And I want to talk about him because he's on a team that's obviously investing a significant amount of money into the present and the future. And we talked so much at the beginning of the year about the fact that, hey, look, they're running a 2018 car during the 2019 season. They went through a series of upgrades and upgrades and upgrades. We thought, or maybe some of us thought, or some people in the media thought, that Stroll had something of a breakthrough in Germany because he had that fourth place finish. It would have been third if he'd managed to kind of keep Kvyat off his back, but he ultimately finishes fourth, picks up a bunch of points. That race is a bit of an anomaly because you and I live streamed that race, and it was crazy. Like, that wasn't a usual race, but he finishes fourth. But consistently, race after race after race after race, he's out-qualified by his teammate Sergio Perez. So we know that for whatever reason, Stroll is snake-bitten and can't get out of Q1. And when he does, he's quickly bumped out of Q2. Sergio Perez, like, he walks through Q1 consistently in Q2, but he's also consistently in the points. And again, as a Canadian fan, I get a little bit emotional because this is now Stroll's third season in Formula One. And if not for the backing maybe of his father, I don't know that he would have a ride next year. But he isn't improving. And the reality is, if he had a teammate that was performing at the same level that he was, struggling to get out of Q1, struggling to get in the points, maybe you'd attribute that to the car. But Stroll's in a position where he has a teammate who just signed a new three-year deal, a three-year extension, who's consistently beating him. And let me take you through their finishes this year. So going back to Australia, Sergio Perez finishes 13th. Stroll had a great finish to start the season. He finishes 9th in the points. The next race, Sergio beats him. He finishes 10th. Lance isn't in the points. China, Sergio 8th. Lance isn't in the points. Azerbaijan, Sergio Perez 6th. Lance 9th in the points, but still beats him. You skip all the way through here. Lance actually beats him in Canada, gets that 9th place finish versus Perez's 12th, so he picks up a couple of points there. You jump through to Belgium. Belgium, Perez finishes 6th. Lance Stroll finishes 17th, or finishes 10th. You jump to Italy. Perez finishes 7th. Lance finishes 12th. They have a really tough race in Singapore. In Russia, Sergio Perez finishes 7th. Lance Stroll finished 11th. You jump to Japan, Sergio Perez finishes 8th. Lance finishes 9th. You jump to this race, Sergio Perez finishes a phenomenal 7th. Lance Stroll finishes 12th. And what really pissed me off about the Stroll performance is with 20 laps, 15 laps left, he's in the points, he's in 15, and he just chokes it up. He just gives it up. And I'm looking, because obviously you've got the timing box on the left side of the screen, you can see the positions, and you've got Kvyat behind him, and he's 2.5 seconds back, and I have zero confidence whatsoever he's going to hold Kvyat off. Yeah. And he doesn't. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, within a blink of an eye, he's suddenly 6 seconds behind Kvyat. Like, for me, I don't know that he's shown the progression this year that I'd want him to see. And he's got a great teammate. And I think Sergio Perez is a good teammate. He's not playing mind games. He's kind of, there's no mental battlefield there that you've seen with Rosberg and Hamilton. Like, he should be developing better and he should be putting in better performances. He's not making mistakes and he's not DNFing because he only has one retirement this year. So he's consistently finishing, but he's not getting in the points enough based on the investment that team's made in that car.
And I completely agree. We've talked about Stroll and Perez and Racing Point throughout this whole season on the podcast, where, you know, Racing Point has done advancements and investments to the car with their tweaks and their upgrades. So it's not like Perez has got a car that's superseded or that much of a greater difference than Stroll's car. It's just going to come down to drivership. Like, Perez is a consistent driver in his wheelhouse, in his space, where he's in the midfield and he's battling with other cars in the midfield. Stroll should be up in there as well. He's not that he's a bad driver. There's something going on with him in terms of, you know, when he's in qualifying, he may not be great at qualifying. You put him in the mix in the race, he has his good days and bad days, but he's not consistent. Yeah. So he needs to develop something where it's either mentally preparing himself, that I've talked about in past podcasts, where something must be going on with him mentally, not being able to get out of qualifying or perform well or be consistent, just like his teammate Perez. But when he's in the race, he can battle, yet he's not in a position where he's gaining points or getting up ahead. So yep. If he was able to get out of qualifying Q1 and have a better qualifying position,
you nailed it.
Then all his efforts, instead of battling from the back of the pack, he's either gaining from the mid or from the front of the pack. Even if he puts himself in a front position at the front of the pack and drops down a few and ends up still in the middle, it's still better in the back, hanging out, talking with the Williams team.
You couldn't have nailed it better. Like, this speaks so much to the importance of qualifying. Like, if you can get into Q2, you're basically going to start 5 positions ahead of where you otherwise would have started. And now he causes so much self-harm by having such terrible Q1 performances. And that's maybe a lot of what we're seeing here. So year-to-date, season-to-date, Sergio Perez has 43 points. Lance Stroll has 21 points. You think if Lance Stroll was more competitive and was putting in the same finishes that Perez was having, like, Racing Point should be 5th. They should displace Renault, and they should be chomping at the bit to get into the top 4. But really, they're 6th, 7th, 8th because Lance's performance has been so poor, and so much of that, like you said, is rooted in his Q1 performance. And to be fair, like, he gets into these races and he'll consistently make up some positions based on qualifying. He's consistent in the sense that he's not DNFing, he's not making bad decisions that lead to damage to the car and things like that. He's not crashing out, but he's also just not performing at the level that you would expect, because again, the baseline is Sergio Perez, and Perez is double the points that he has. Yeah. So I'm frustrated.
I know, I can see that. And I was hopeful for Racing Point because of Stroll's father picking up the team, the talks and everything they've been talking about with the changes at the vehicle and what they're doing to
building
progress.
Building a new factory, spending hundreds of millions of dollars or investing hundreds of millions of dollars into improving that team. They have the best power unit. They're rocking the Mercedes power unit, for crying out loud.
Yeah, so I was really surprised that, you know, we're at this point of the season and Racing Point has been really delivered on the hype or what they were talking about early in the season that I was hopeful for. The surprising one to me is McLaren. McLaren is the one where they've had a lot of troubles in the past, But this season, they've turned it around. Both their drivers, Norris and Sainz, have put on impressive qualifyings and positions this season. So kudos to McLaren. You know, I always say a lot about McLaren from previous seasons, but this year, they're the ones who surprised me and turned it around.
Newer viewers probably have a... Again, if you tuned into Formula One in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, you're probably used to McLaren being a backmarker because they struggled so much when they made that transition to the Honda Hybrid Power Unit in, I guess, 2015. They really struggled. There was tons of reliability issues. Fernando Alonso, for all of his greatness, winning a couple of titles in 05 and 06, he was also very vocal, and I think that probably exacerbated the situation a little bit because if you didn't make those didn't come to those conclusions on your own about the fact that they were struggling, he was very clear that they were struggling. He would talk on the radio about how terrible the power unit was, et cetera, et cetera. But you're right, like they're now rocking that Renault unit. So that divorce, we've talked about that, divorce where they walked away from Honda, paired up with Red Bull and Toro Rosso, and ultimately McLaren went and paired up now short-term with Renault, has been a great thing. You look at the standings year-to-date, Mercedes 652 points after Mexico, Ferrari 466, Red Bull 341, McLaren Renault 111. I think they've probably got to be, despite the fact that they didn't pick up any points in Mexico, I think they have to be pretty happy with that performance. In the last four races, they have 5 points finishes and a retirement. So they're being consistent, and I think they've got to be pretty happy. And what's really exciting is they're going to go into next year with the Renault power unit, and then they switch to Mercedes power for 2021. Whatever that power unit looks like, because we don't actually know, they're going to switch to the Mercedes power unit for 2021. But I would agree. Like for me, I think they're probably the most improved player of the year from a constructor standpoint.
Yeah, hopefully they can build from this season. And they were talking about that merger with Mercedes to get back into a top line team to be in contention with the other top line drivers and top line teams.
Yeah, and for our newer listeners as well, I think it's probably worth your time to go back and do a little bit of research. But before Mercedes came on board as a full-time factory team after the 2010 season, when they basically bought out Braun and Braun was already running a Mercedes engine, they had an incredibly close-knit relationship with Mercedes where they were feeding Mercedes power units at the time, the V8s, they were feeding power units into McLaren, and they had an incredibly close relationship both on the Formula One side but also on the road car side. And ultimately that relationship, for a number of different reasons, slowly dissolved over time, partly because McLaren started developing its own road car ambitions, which kind of conflicted with what Mercedes were doing themselves, and Mercedes wanted to start providing engines to other teams. And then all of a sudden Mercedes had their own factory team. It kind of compromised the really tight knit relationship they had. So they kind of broke apart. McLaren went to Honda, McLaren went to Renault. Now they're coming back to Mercedes, as so many teams do, simply because their power units are so reliable. Yeah, so ultimately really disappointed in Lance Stroll. That was a really roundabout way of getting back to that. But yeah, pretty disappointed. Any other thoughts from the race?
No, I think that's good. I think you've summed up everything that you want to talk about with Stroll. I think I pointed out some of the highlights and lowlights of the Mexican Grand Prix.
Yeah, and I should just mention as well one other quick thing too. We didn't talk a lot about the track. So for those of you that are interested, it's a 17-turn track. So it's not a full-time circuit built on the outskirts of suburban or metro Mexico City. It's a track that's based very much in the center of the city. And I think we should probably call out as well that one of the things that makes Mexico City unique is not only its size, it's gigantic. Mexico City proper houses about 9 million people, and Metro Mexico City houses about 21 million people. So it's a major metropolitan area. It's also very, very, very high up. It's 22,240 meters above sea level, and that impacts the teams in a lot of ways, both in terms of the way the cars react, both in the terms of the fact that it takes human beings a while to condition themselves to being able to function at that altitude. So it's an interesting race for a lot of reasons. The track itself is built in a park. It's It's kind of existed in three iterations over the years. So the Mexican Grand Prix was held in the same location on a similar track from 63 to 70. It was held there once again from 86 to 92. And it's been there again since 2015. And like I said, Rosberg won in 15, Hamilton won in 16, and then Verstappen took the last two races. Hamilton did win a championship there, although he wasn't on the podium for that one. But it's a really, really, really cool track. It's 17 turns. It's a high-speed track. It has the longest single starting straight of any track at about, well, I think it's probably close to 300 meters. Typically, the Ferraris do well in qualifying, although like we saw with this race, they locked out the front row, but they ultimately don't get a win and they only get one podium
finish. And they've
got
top line speed.
Yeah, they've got the top line speed, which kind of plays into the long straights, but it is an incredibly well-attended event. The capacity of the track on race day is about 110,000. Over the race weekend, the 3 days this year, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they drew 350,000 people. And the fans, like, I've never been, and I'm a little bit spooked to go because of the whole perception about security and safety in Mexico and Mexico City, but it looks absolutely bananas. It looks like a festival. And I absolutely love the fact that, and we can talk about this, there's a portion of the track that actually snakes through a baseball stadium. So it's this really intimate enclosure where you basically have a section of this track that snakes through the baseball stadium. And that's also where the podium is. Yes. But it's incredibly cool to see the fans eat it up. The track is jammed for free practice, for qualifying for the race. The folks love it, and this is one of those races that the sport has to do everything it can possibly do to keep.
And aside from the altitude that you mentioned earlier, for race day, the track temperature was 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38 degrees Celsius. That played into a lot of the drivers' tire management,
the
brake cooling.
Yep.
You know, Hamilton was talking about, everything about his tires, about, you know, if it's going to be like degrading or if it's, or the brakes are going to be too hot or the ducting and the cooling.
Yeah.
You know, track temperature plays a lot into the vehicle's performance as well.
And the teams, and I don't know if our listeners notice as well, but the team's aerodynamic package often differs for this race as well. And sometimes they're subtle, but you probably notice a lot of the teams brought out much bigger rear wings for this weekend, specifically because of the altitude and the heat and a lot of the things that they would have encountered. But overall, I think this is a really important race for the championship, because it's one thing to place a race, and we'll talk about this in a little bit. It's one thing to place a race in a city because the track or the race organizers are willing to cut you a check for $20 or $30 or $40 million. It's another to put a race in a city that absolutely embraces the event and turns it into a carnival and turns it into a festival. And I would be heartbroken if Mexico, if the sport walked away from Mexico City at any given point, because if you're jamming 350,000 people there and 110,000 people on race day, this is a city that's demonstrated its passion for the sport. And this is what the sport needs less so than it does, or more so than it does, to be putting this sport in a city that doesn't really have any passion or love for what the event really brings.
And I agree. And for Mexico, this is great for its economics, and it's great for its infrastructure.
Yep.
It draws a highlight or a marker for Mexico, for if not just for the year.
Yep.
You know, they're having the race during the Day of the Dead season.
Yep.
So
exactly. Yeah. It's festival season.
Yep, exactly.
It's a party atmosphere. I think it's, and like we talked about, it's good for the city, and the city deserves it, because we probably wouldn't be talking about Mexico City, period, if not for the fact that there was an F1 race there. But all of a sudden, it becomes this appealing travel destination because it's a festival season, because of the culture. All of a sudden, there's a race there. And I know you've talked in the past about possibly going to Mexico City with your friends, and you would probably never have that conversation if there wasn't a race there. But I'm just so happy that the city and the fans and the people embrace it.
Yeah, no, it's good. I like it.
Okay, cool.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Search for Flash F1 Official.
All right, so we talked a lot during the last podcast, and we talked a lot about Renault and what was potentially going to happen with Renault after, and it was rumored, it was reported that Racing Point, for whatever reason, had sussed out that potentially they were rocking some brake bias technology that was illegal based on the rules and regulations of the sport. Ultimately, it's since been reported that that wasn't necessarily the case, but rather that Racing Point had been made aware, potentially because a former employee of Renault who's now working for Racing Point had helped them understand that this technology existed. And by all accounts, what really had happened was Racing Point approached the FIA and said, hey, we want that. And FIA's like, no, you can't. And then all of a sudden Racing Point's like, well, why can they? So based on some onboard footage from preseason testing, it became pretty clear that these cars had the ability to adjust the brake bias without input from the drivers, and ultimately they were penalized. And I'm not going to get into the semantics of how the penalty was applied because I don't really understand it, but ultimately they were disqualified. Both cars were disqualified from the Japanese Grand Prix, and I think the question is, Renault got off pretty darn light because all the evidence suggests they've been rocking this system for the entire season, but both cars were ultimately disqualified, so Renault lost their constructors' points, and both drivers lost their drivers' points as well.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting news. Realistically, any sort of driver aid to automatically or preset the front or rear brake bias is a complete no-no to the FIA. Yeah. So yep. They want a lot of human interaction or car to driver interaction as opposed to automatically setting these brake biases or any sort of driver aid during the race.
Yeah. And it's interesting too. So I'm going to read a quote from a story here, but Otmar Schnauzeflanier.
Awesome pronunciation. Yeah. I love that.
That's terrible. That's as good as I could go. And I practiced that before the race. But the Racing Point team principal said this. You know, in Silverstone, basically, they had some challenges. And if we remember, Perez ended up running into Nico Hülkenberg at the restart after the safety car. And I quote, as I'm sure everyone does, we started looking at our competitors to see what they do better than we do. And that's when we noticed that Renault had the system that we really wanted. The process started at Silverstone. We then wrote to the FIA asking if we could do the same, and the FIA had written back and said, we can't. That was the point at which, obviously, the complaint came forward. Interestingly, and I've got another quote here as well, and this is from, let's take a look here. This is from Renault, and Renault says, we'd like to clarify some facts. A video from Barcelona testing, which would have been preseason, is doing the rounds. It shows a legal system known by and now confirmed by the FIA to be compliant with the technical regulations. As we had nothing to hide regarding this innovative system, we hid nothing. The information submitted by Racing Point, admitted in front of us and the FIA members after the Japanese GP, was received via a Renault F1 team ex-employee who had joined Racing Point, and not only via this video. So there's some confusion here because Renault seems to think that this system is still legal, even though ultimately they decided that they weren't going to petition against the disqualification. They say, hey, it's fair, we'll take it. We're not gonna argue against this, which is kind of interesting. But they're still arguing that the system was legal. They're also arguing that Racing Point only knows about it because a former employee told them about it, whereas Racing Point saying, actually, we only knew about it after Silverstone because we wanted to improve our system. That's when we discovered it. And then there's this video from preseason testing showing them using this system, Renault that is. It's all a bit of a mess, and I kind of feel like Renault got off really, really lucky here, especially if it's generally understood that they've been using it all season.
Yeah, so it looks like they knew that they were somewhat being assisted or cheating, yet they don't want to, you know, contend anything because they're like, okay, yeah, we did cheat, but yes, you know, we didn't do anything wrong. We want to continue using the system, which you're not allowed to anyway. So other teams pointing it out, good for them, but it's supposed to be an equal playing field. Every driver, every car is supposed to be following the rules.
Yep.
Again, I talked about other teams that complained about Mercedes' wheel ducting system a couple of seasons ago. Yep. So. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because I think if you're new to the sport, there's a lot of driver aids in modern road cars that we take for granted that racing car drivers at the Formula One level don't get, because the FIA and Formula One walk this really tight line between automating these cars to the point where the driver is irrelevant or introducing some degree of risk and chance by making the drivers do more work. So there's this constant push and pull where the regulations want to create a sport where driving talent really matters, but the teams will constantly push the limits of those regulations because they want to create the most competitive car possible. So there's this constant push and pull, but there's a lot of driver's aids in modern road cars that you will not see in Formula One cars. And I think fans are often surprised by that.
it's difficult because of the fact that these cars nowadays are so technically advanced. Like, there's so much into them. If you look at just a steering wheel, there's so many buttons and controls and dials and knobs that a driver has to control that steering wheel and all the dials and knobs as they're driving in a high-speed race. There was a point, there was a few seasons where the teams weren't allowed to coach
the drivers. Yeah, that was garbage.
And tell them what to do as they're driving. They wanted the drivers to figure it out and race and do everything. There's just too much going on.
They couldn't. They could only share limited intel about the status and health of the car.
Yeah.
So they had all this telemetry data, and they had all this data coming from the power unit and from the brakes and the tires, but they couldn't report that to the driver. And I remember, I still specifically remember a conversation between Hamilton and his engineer and how frustrated both of them were that Hamilton couldn't get the information, the engineer couldn't share it. But that was another example where Formula One did realize it was a mistake.
They were doing it anyway. They were just talking in code.
Sure.
Just like, you know, other sports where they'll just use football, like they'll just say some sort of coded play and to describe what they want to do. So realistically, all these things, I want to see a lot more driver ability during the race. Yes, I agree with that. But when you look at these cars, they're so complex, they're so technically advanced with all the stuff that got going on. I don't know how a driver has time to think about what he needs to do with all these dials and buttons as they're trying to not hit anybody driving beside them or make these high speed turns. It's just, there's too much going on.
They did talk about that during the broadcast today as well, about the fact that these drivers not only have to pilot these cars, and I honestly think that term is the best verb. Like, they're piloting these cars like you would pilot a fighter jet. And they not only have to keep this car on the road, they have to keep it at speed to keep the heat in the tires, because if they can't get the heat in the tires, they can't brake and they can't corner, and then they're going to go off. But they also have to be fully, just like you said, they have to be fully aware of what every single other driver is doing on the track. And it's crazy. It's crazy what they do. And then from a team perspective, you want to do everything you can possibly do to benefit your driver and make the drive a little bit easier for them. But then there's regulations, and that's where that push and pull comes in, where the teams want to do everything they can to be as competitive as possible. But the sport's also saying, like, hey, look, we still need the drivers to do as much work as possible to make this a sport. So
yeah, it's just, like I said, too much going on. Kudos to the drivers for being able to do that. For me, I can't even drive and eat a hamburger at the same time. So
you shouldn't be eating a hamburger.
I want to eat and drive. I'm hungry.
So that came off harsh. You're allowed to eat a hamburger. But based on our very, very, very strict distracted driving laws in British Columbia and Vancouver, you probably shouldn't be eating a hamburger, because I'm pretty sure that's like a $400 ticket with four penalty points on your license.
It's going to get cold, man. I'm telling you. I got to eat it right out of the drive-thru.
So I don't know if I mentioned this on last week's podcast, and I probably should have, but Gil was kind, because we were recorded at his studio last week, but Gil was kind enough last week to get sandwiches in advance. You know, he's going to go to a restaurant and pick up some sandwiches. So my sandwich featured the following: bread, mayo, and cucumber. Nothing else. No protein, no other veggies, nothing. And then, because I think he'd kind of done it as a joke, but then the kicker was like, hey, you know what, if you don't want that sandwich, and I ate it out of principle, he got me another sandwich, which was ham, knowing that I don't eat pork. So so thank you for your gracious hosting of last week's event. It was wonderful.
I had chips and dip for you as well.
I ate a lot of those because I was so hungry. All right. Anything else from a news and gossip perspective?
No, I think...
So we've got some great mailbag questions this week, but I think maybe the last thing to touch on is this. All season, going back to our conversation with Tim Maraney back in, I think it was May or June, we've been talking about the fact that the sport's going to transform in 2021 with a completely new formula, new regulations around aerodynamics, about wheel dimensions, widths, offsets, the chassis material, car parts, the engine, everything. So initially, it looked like the sport was going to completely blow up the current formula and create something that would create a little bit more parity and allow cars to follow and chase each other and overtake a little bit more. As time's gone on, it's been speculated that the bigger teams, the Red Bulls, Mercedes, Ferraris of the world, have really been pushing back and resisting a complete change, and that we're probably going to see something in 2021 that's probably closer to what we have now than it was the original hope. But it's speculated that there'll be an announcement next Thursday in Austin that's going to outline what those changes are. So we'd always heard that they would announce them in October, and they're going to do it on the very, potentially they're going to do it on the very last day. And if they do, we've got a very special podcast set up for a week or two after that, where we're going to break down what those 2021 regulations mean for the sport and what 2021 will actually look like. But that was kind of the last memo that I had, was that it's going to be pretty interesting to see.
Nice.
Cool. You want to take some mailbag questions?
Yeah, let's do this.
So I think I'm going to ask you this one here. This is from Lawrence, one of our listeners in Vancouver. He's got a couple of great questions here. The first one was this: what does Bottas need to do to beat Hamilton? What are your thoughts on this one? Because I've got some thoughts, but I want to hear your perspective on this one.
Okay, so I think this question just came in like last minute, so I haven't had a chance to think about this. So I'm just going to shoot from the hip here. I think he needs to communicate and work better with his team. So Mercedes, Hamilton has his pit crew, his team.
His engineer.
And for this particular race, he didn't have his specific
engineer with him for two weeks.
So I think Bottas needs to have that same type of relationship with the engineer or the, whoever he communicates with on his part of the Mercedes team that works on his car. And I think having that relationship like Hamilton has with his engineer for several years will probably help him throughout the race. Yeah. You know, he's a good driver. We've seen earlier in the previous races that he has good qualifying, has been able to be up front and hold good positions for the race. But I just think he needs a better team dynamic or a team relationship.
Yeah, so he needs a better... So your argument is he needs a better supporting cast. He needs a really, really great engineer. He needs a great set of mechanics. He needs to have that really tight unit that Hamilton's had, because Hamilton's had a pretty consistent unit, engineer, et cetera, for basically the entire balance of his time at Mercedes, right? Yeah.
So I think Bottas is doing everything right. Like I said, he's gotten some good qualifying, some good positions. He's got a few podiums this year. I think just to... And that's just him. So yeah. I want to see him elevate it, and hopefully he's got a good support group in his Mercedes team to deliver, you know, better results for him for the upcoming seasons.
Yeah, I'm going to take a different approach on this one, because I don't think he will ever beat Hamilton. I don't think he has the mental toughness to beat Hamilton. And I think we've talked a lot about this. We talked about the fact that in 2016, Nico Rosberg had to enlist every single emotional warfare tactic known to man to bring down the monster that was Hamilton to win that championship. And I think he was willing to do everything and anything to win that championship.
Oh, he did.
And I don't think that's in Valtteri Bottas's, I don't think that's in his arsenal of weapons. Like, I don't think that's his personality. And I think, you know, if Hamilton racked up 5 DNFs next year and he was in a position to win the title, he may. But all things being equal, and if Hamilton's as reliable next year as he has been this year, I don't see him doing the things that it would take to beat Hamilton. Hamilton's just too good and too reliable.
So you want Bottas to be a bit more aggressive, to be all about him, me?
Yeah, 100%.
I agree. If you're racing and you want to be a champion, you need to do what you need to do and look after your own game.
And we also don't know what the dynamics of that team are. They may have been very clear to Bottas when they brought him on that, look, you know what, you are the wingman to Hamilton and you're a support player and you're going to win some races. But at the end of the day, we're committed to making Lewis Hamilton a champion. Now, that might change if for whatever reason Bottas was up 40 points at this point in the season versus Hamilton. They're not going to compromise that championship. But I just don't think... If he's trailing Hamilton or if it's close, I don't think he has the mental strength to beat Hamilton. And that's not a dig at Valtteri Bottas, because I don't think many drivers would. I think that's more of a compliment to Lewis Hamilton and his strengths.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the championship points, he's close to Hamilton. Like Hamilton wasn't able to take the championship during this race, so Bottas finishing third keeps him in the points contention
right now
for championship.
They're 74 points apart. Yep. So if Hamilton increases that spread by 4 points during the next race, he wins the championship. But I don't think it's in question. another question from Lawrence, and this is a really good one as well. So you didn't see this until after the race, and we kind of watched it together, but was the car on the podium necessary in Mexico? So for our listeners that didn't hear this, this was bananas. So the podium celebration takes place in that baseball stadium that we talked about. It looks cool. There's a great atmosphere. They let the fans out onto the track. During the broadcast, you see up on the podium, you see Bottas, you see Sebastian Vettel, but Hamilton's not there. And then all of a sudden, and they've kind of got this kind of tight shot, but from a distance, all of a sudden you see Hamilton raising up from nowhere, standing on top of his car. They basically had this ramp, and this ramp put the car onto a platform, and then they raised the platform up to the level of the podium with Hamilton on it. So it was this grand reveal showing the car and showing Hamilton. And I think Lawrence's question was that maybe over the top? Was that unnecessary? What were your thoughts on the reveal?
Yeah, so I don't think it was necessary. I think I mentioned to you earlier was that I think the Mexican Grand Prix expected Hamilton to take the championship, and they had this elevated car ramp thing prepared for him winning the championship.
Maybe.
And they decided to just use it anyway, whether he won or not. So it's like, hey, we invested in this. Let's just use it and show it off. But I don't think it was necessary. But, you know,
it was cool. I wouldn't be upset if we never saw it again. Like,
I'm just wondering what like Vettel and Bottas are thinking. Like, hey, yeah, give me our trophies, and here's this Yahoo on his car being raised right up in front of us. Like, come on, I never thought about that. This is too flash for Formula One, right?
And the other thing too is it's not like we don't see the cars, because all we see of the drivers during the race is their helmet and the car. We don't see their faces or their expressions, but we see the car for 50 or 60 or 70 laps. Like, we don't really need to see the car, and we don't really need to celebrate the car on the podium. Like, that's a moment for the drivers to celebrate. And all of a sudden, if you're Bottas or Sebastian Vettel, like you said, and you're suddenly sharing the stage with a Mercedes, like, I don't know, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, get this loser off.
Yeah, so that was interesting. And he's got a final question. Yeah. And the ironic thing about this question is, when you arrived here today at the studio, when we're talking about, hey, did you see that? Because we're kind of like, did you see the car? And you're like, nah, man, I had to go and shower. So his question is this: why does Gil have videos of him showering on Instagram? So if you don't follow Gil, he does a special thing on Tuesdays that I'll let you explain. Maybe explain to the listeners what it is you do. Is it Tuesdays?
Well, Tuesdays I do what's called on my personal Instagram, a towel Tuesday, where every Tuesday I put on a different towel, or I do some sort of act or greeting with a towel on my head, completely different every Tuesday. What Lawrence is talking about is I do a story time Saturday where through my whole day, my whole Saturday, starting from when I get up in my bed. I post an Instagram story, and every pretty much step by step of what I'm doing throughout that day, I post on Instagram. So there's a few Instagram stories of me actually in the shower. I've gotten some questions like, hey, who's holding the phone or the camera while you're showering? And why are you?
I'll be very clear to our listeners. It's not me. It's not me. This is outside of the Flash F1 scope.
Yeah, I've got my camera, my phone rig set up in all over the house, so I can selfie stick myself anywhere I want.
Okay. Hopefully that answered that question.
Yeah. I hope you listeners follow Gil Digler on Instagram. Check out my stories and my showering.
This next question is from another local follower, so a listener from Surrey, Miguel. He asked this question: do you think the Miami GP is a benefit or a deterrent to the sport as a whole? Could be viewed as a biased push from an American consortium to focus on an American market instead of the health and heart as a whole of the sport. So we talked a little bit about this earlier. Your thoughts. So, you know, we had that podcast recently about the economics of the sport. We talked about the fact that, hey, they're probably not even going to get any hosting fees for having this event. What are your thoughts on the Miami GP? Does it help the sport as a whole? Does it hurt the sport? What are your thoughts?
Okay, personally, I think the Miami track for 2021 will help the sport. If these new changes, if this new Formula One is to evolve, you're going to want to have some changes. You want to be able to introduce newer tracks and mix it up a bit. It can't be stagnant or plateau with all these. Don't get me wrong, I love a lot of the classic tracks like Silverstone, but if you want to grow the sport into different areas and different markets, you need to expose it to those different areas and different markets. So getting a secondary North American track like Miami, completely different from any other area, I think it's good for the sport. You're exposing Formula One to other areas and bring it into an area where you wouldn't suspect it. If you watched yesterday's pre-qualifying, Ross Brawn and Martin Brundle talked about the Miami track. It's a 5.6 kilometer circuit, averaging speeds about 230 kilometers. Braun is all for it. He's talking about...
I have mad respect for Braun, by the way.
Yeah, so him and Martin Brundle were talking about how this is going to be great for the sport, and I completely agree. Mark?
You know, it's funny. I'm so torn on this one because I agree that... So, yeah, this is how torn on this I am. So to be clear, the American Media Consortium that that Miguel is speaking to is Liberty Media. And Liberty Media is the company that bought Formula One in February of 2017 from the former investment group. So the sport is itself owned. All the teams are privately owned. FIA is a completely separate body. But Formula One, the commercial rights holder, is an American-owned body. So naturally, I think they're motivated to enhancing the visibility of the sport in their home market, because right now they have one race. And before Austin, it'd been years since they'd had a race in that country at all. So I think they see the US as possibly the single biggest market to grow the sport. And obviously they want to grow the sport. They want to grow viewership. They want to grow hosting fees, all that kind of stuff. But amongst the things that we learned last week was this: ESPN, which is broadcasting the races in the States, pays nothing. So that Formula One, out of the goodness of their heart, is basically giving ESPN these races. So whatever ESPN generates from advertising revenue, that's pure cash because they're not paying anything to Formula One. But the other thing too is, and you have to listen to a couple of our last podcasts for us to kind of get into the details on this one, Miami isn't going to be paying any hosting fees either. But even then, there's still an outside shot that this race is even going to happen, because if you've read and followed any of the media stories, initially it was proposed for downtown Miami on the water, and I was freaking in. That would have been unbelievable. It would have been a beautiful TV spectacle. It was never going to happen because the people that live in those condos downtown were opposed to it. So ultimately they decide, Stephen Ross, he's the owner of the Miami Dolphins, he's the one that's leading the group that wants to bring the event to Miami. He's like, hey, you know what? I own this NFL stadium out in the suburbs. Come and race there. The problem there is that it's actually right in the middle of a bedroom community. Like, on all four sides of the track are acres and acres of suburban housing estates, and they want to put this race in the middle of these four bedroom communities. So the county, Miami-Dade County, and the county commissioner are fighting tooth and nail to prevent this from ever happening. Now, all of that nonsense aside, I think having another race in the US would be great. I don't know where you're going to put it, because I think you would find the same opposition in California, because there aren't going to be public dollars to put a track, build a new track in California. The tracks that exist in California probably aren't suitable for F1 without a pretty significant investment. You have Austin, which has the best Formula One track in the United States. Maybe you go back to Indy and you invest some money there to get that track back up. New York's probably never going to happen. It was rumored for a long time, and you also don't want to get too close to Montreal. You can't come to the Pacific Northwest because of all the environmental concerns, so maybe Miami's your only choice. And Miami is a sexy destination. Like, I want it to work. Like, I really, really do. But if they can't make it work at the stadium site, are they going to host it in a swamp next? Because originally it was downtown. That didn't work out. Let's do it in the suburbs. That doesn't work out. Are you going to hold it in the swamps?
Well, they're saying that the stadium site, it's not going to be a dedicated Formula One track.
So no, it's not.
When they're not hosting Formula One, they're going to start tearing down some parts and use that stadium for other events.
Yeah, it's basically they're hosting it in the parking lot. Part of the track is going to be on a public road, but for all intents and purposes, it's being held around a football stadium and in the parking lot. And maybe they'll do some permanent grandstand builds, but the track itself will only be used for this race weekend.
So just like with Mexico, I think this is going to be good for the US. You've already laid out where Formula One tracks can or cannot go.
Yeah.
So for Miami, for North America, we have a lot of European, we have a lot of Asian and other Formula One races that are in abundance in those areas. But for North America, aside from Canada, aside from Austin, there's really not too much. So again, to grow the sport, to give that accessibility for Formula One, put it in Miami, whether it's a good or crappy track, just to get that exposure. Let's try it. If it doesn't work,
they can dump it like any other track
that they just move on.
So to that,
they're not losing anything because they can reuse that stadium track anyway.
Yeah, there's no harm. They're not dropping $1 billion on a permanent track. It's going to be a temporary track. You give it a try. Now that said, they've still got to get public approval to make this happen, and I'm not confident they will. But I'd like it's I'm willing to give it a try. Yeah. I'm willing to give it a try. And if it helps enhance the popularity and the exposure of the sport, then maybe in a couple of years when this free ESPN deal's up, Formula One can go back to ESPN and say, hey, look, you know what? We now have two races in the U.S. Our ratings are increasing. More people are watching the sport. This time you need to basically hand over a fistful of money to get these TV rights, or we're going to go to ABC, or we're going to go to Fox, or whoever it might be. So that was a long-winded answer, but I think we kind of answered that question. You had a question about driving shoes from a listener, Logan. Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take that one.
Sure.
So I think his question was regarding, what was the question again?
Yeah, let me bring this one up. So actually, Logan had two questions.
Okay.
And one of them, Logan, we're actually going to defer. We've got a very special guest coming on in a couple of weeks. You had a question about, hey, you know, why are cars running V6 motors now rather than the V8s, V10, V12s of yesteryear? We could answer that question, but we've got a very special guest that's going to come in a couple of weeks. And we wanted to tee that question to him so you can get the answer from a professional. But your other question is, question two, is do all F1 drivers wear different shoes for more grip or more comfort? So I'm assuming, because I know you're a bit of a sneakerhead based on creeping your Instagram, but I'm assuming you mean the shoes, the Alpine Store shoes that the drivers typically wear during a race.
So the shoes that the drivers wear, aside from their crash helmet being the most important piece of driving equipment that they have, the shoes are also just as important. So the driver's shoes are custom made for them.
Yeah.
Okay. They're in their cars for hours and hours. So they need to have gear and equipment that are both functional and durable.
Yeah.
So the drivers, when they put these shoes on, they're custom made. They're almost like a second sock.
Yeah.
And when they, if you've ever sat in a cockpit of a Formula One car, not that I have, but I've seen it. It's very tight, very narrow. So their feet are really close together. You can't have big clunky shoes that are going to hamper their drivability. Yep. So they have to have custom-made shoes, and they're very soft. So how the driver drives, when they put these shoes on, the driver feels the car. Everything goes through the shoes. So how they're, whenever they drive, they feel, you know, if there's any vibration or how the car reacts or feels, that's being all felt through the foot. So they have to have a very comfortable, very durable shoe that they can, is both going to be functional and comfortable for them when they're driving.
Yeah, I think to answer your question, and there's really only a couple of companies that actually produce these shoes, Alpine Stars being one of them, Sparco being another one, although I think Alpine Star is kind of the predominant presence in Formula One. It kind of has to be both. One, the shoes have to be extremely lightweight, but they have to have a tremendous amount of breathability because to Gil's point, like the principal way that you interface with the brake and the throttle is with your feet. And if you're in that car for 2 hours, which is the typical length of a Formula One Grand Prix, these shoes have to breathe incredibly well because those cockpits get absurdly hot, whether it's warm outside or not. I fortunately have had the opportunity to sit in a Formula One car and I was wearing sneakers.
Must be nice.
And yeah, you can't move your feet inside one of those cars. Like they almost have to function as a second sock. So breathability is a big part of that, but they also wear incredibly quickly. So the drivers will actually go through two or three pairs during the course of a season. And there were some shots earlier this year that I think Kim Illman, one of the more popular Formula One photographers he had managed to get, but he'd got some shots of wear on the shoes after practice sessions and things like that. And the drivers will often wear through them. So again, they got to be light, they got to be able to breathe, and there's got to be a tremendous amount of grip. How they perform outside of the car is totally irrelevant, but absolutely, they need to be as light as they can possibly be while also being genuinely fireproof, much like the rest of the racing suit itself. So I don't know if we answered the question, but I like your Yeezys, by the way, that I saw on your, not yours, that Logan that
Logan.
I saw on his Instagram account. But yeah, we'll take that question regarding the engine a little bit later because I wanted to jump into that one, but we thought it'd be better to save that one. One final question, and this one's kind of interesting. So Albert from Atlanta, the ATL Hotlanta, had a couple of questions for us. The first one was, and it's kind of a question for both of us, what song sums up Hamilton's season so far? So what pop song, what rock song, whatever the case is, what song best sums up Lewis Hamilton's season? I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And then the other one was, what song sums up Williams' season? So Williams, 10th place in the constructors, one point this year, 1 point from Germany. That's it. Your answers. share your answers with the audience.
Okay, for me, for the song that sums up Hamilton's season, I've got by Blackpink.
Okay, so I knew you were going to go there, and I was hoping you wouldn't. How does that possibly sum up his season?
Okay, so Hamilton's good. Blackpink's good. Hamilton's number one in Formula One right now. Blackpink, they're number one in K-pop right now.
Okay.
And their song, if you've heard it,
okay,
it's all about gunshots. So, you know, Hamilton's on fire. He's just shooting bullets at everybody. And yeah, he's taking the win.
Oh,
so
God.
Blackpink, Flashers, if you haven't seen the video, go watch it. It's almost at 1 million views on YouTube.
A million or a billion?
Yeah, a billion. I'm sorry. 1 billion views. That's how good they are. 1 billion. They're almost at 1 billion.
So
views, and that song's only been out a year.
Yeah, the obsession's getting creepy, but let's go on to the next one. So that's the song that you believe sums up Hamilton's season?
Yes.
What song do you think sums up William's season?
Okay, for me, it's Loser by Beck. I'm a loser, baby, so why don't you kill me?
Oh.
It's fitting.
Yeah, it's been a tough run for Williams. And again, I have a soft spot for that team. I've been to Grove. I've seen the factory. I've seen the Heritage Center. Like this has been a disastrous season. And they lose Valtteri Bottas at the end of 2016 because he goes to join Mercedes when Rosberg runs away, retires, I guess. They struggle in 17 when they had Massa, who was kind of forced out of retirement, and they had Stroll. He had that one podium, and that was kind of the highlight of that season. Last year, it was Stroll and Sorokin, and it was really a bad year. And I think a lot of people kind of assume they'd hit the basement. And then this year, they bring in that really young, talented driver, George Russell, a Mercedes product, and they bring in Kubica after a long kind of a long period away from Formula One as he recovered from that rallying accident. But the year couldn't have gone any worse for Williams, to be totally honest.
Okay, so what are your two songs?
One that was the question. I completely...
Yeah. Well, yeah. You're rambling on. I'm here staring at you, waiting for you to...
I completely forgot. So my song for Williams is, and I'm going to be a little bit more upbeat than you, Shake It Off by Taylor Swift. You know, hopefully they're going to be playing that in the factory all winter as they try to be competitive for 2020. And my song for Hamilton, obviously drop the coins, is Drake's Trophies, because he has just, well, he's about to close his sixth straight, well, not his sixth straight, but his sixth overall driver's championship. That six chips, that six trophies. He's one away from Michael Schumacher, who finished with seventh. And who knows, maybe next year, the last year of this current power unit formula, maybe next year is the opportunity to tie and we go from there. And I think as long as he's close to Schumacher, he's going to be motivated and engaged to stay in the sport. So my answer was Taylor Swift, Shake It Off for Williams. Seriously,
nice.
It's fun. It's upbeat. It doesn't take away from the fact that they've had a terrible season, but you know what? You want to look forward. And then obviously Drake's Trophies for Hamilton, because he's the king of the world and he is going to wrap up his sixth title in Austin probably.
And you're a big Drake fan.
And I'm a big Drake fan. And any opportunity I have to drop that. And for once, I'm not wearing any OVO, which is a little bit strange as well. Okay, so we've got to go because we've got to get ready for our work week. And then next weekend, we're in Austin. It's a quick turnaround. It's a little bit strange because typically the calendar is Austin and then Mexico and then Brazil. But this year, they started in Mexico and then they bounce back north to Austin. Then they fly south to Brazil. But we've got a quick turnaround next weekend. So it'll be our fourth pod in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Anything else for the listeners today?
No, I'm good. I think we've given them a lot with this podcast and your special podcast and our Japanese podcast. We've been running like back to back.
And we've got a whole bunch more mailbag questions, everybody. So if we didn't answer your question, and I know we were soliciting questions at one point, don't be upset. We're going to kind of circle back to the rest of those after Austin. But we head to Austin right now from a championship perspective. Hamilton, 363 points. Valtteri Bottas, 289. Charles Leclerc, 236. Max Verstappen, 230. Sebastian Vettel, 220. And then you drop down to Carlos Sainz at 76. And from a constructor's perspective, obviously, Mercedes is running away from the field at 652 points. Ferrari has 466 points. Red Bull has 341. And McLaren, like we talked about earlier, is at 111 points. And Racing Point should probably be there, except for the fact that Lance Stroll has been a little bit disappointed this year. And I'm excited to get Tim Haraney back on again later this season because, you know what, like us, he's a big advocate for Lance Stroll, and I'd really like to talk to him about his thoughts about Lance's performance since we last spoke to him and whether he's kind of lived up to what that car is capable of, especially seeing how Sergio Perez has driven this weekend and this season to date. Cool. Anything else, my friend?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay.
Peace.
Thanks everyone for joining us. You have been a great audience. This is Sarah signing off at Flash F1 with Gil and Mark. Join us next time as we recap the US Grand Prix in Austin.